This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Support comes from Wise, the smart way to manage the currencies you need around the world. Your life is global. Your money should be too. Some providers promise no fees on overseas transfers. Don't be fooled. Extra costs often hide in bloated exchange rates. Choose Wise. You can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies. Count on the exchange rate that you'd usually see on Google. That's how millions save billions on hidden fees. Be smart. Get Wise. Visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Türkiye is a golfer's paradise, and much of that is down to Belek on the country's southern Mediterranean coast. Courses here cut through lush pine forest, set on fast, sandy ground that's kept in immaculate condition all year round. And for those never quite ready to call it a day, Belek is also host to the first full 18-hole floodlit course in Europe. Local pro Dennis Sutmaz is lucky enough to call Belek her training ground.
There are more than 15 courses. You can play golf in winter and summer.
And once the round is done, long lunches replace scorecards, and spas, hammams, and slow afternoons take over.
When I'm not playing golf, I usually go to the beach, tan, go into the sea. You just feel like you're in another world.
Because in Belek, luxury isn't about excess. It's about time well spent. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Right now, the missiles and drones are flying. The bombs are falling. The stage is dominated by threats, explosions, worries about stranded citizens and oil and gas prices. But what comes after all that? Iran isn't Liechtenstein. It's a country of 93 million people speaking a myriad different languages, whose supreme leader and his entourage have been eliminated, and who now have been invited by the US president to rise up and seize power. So, is there a plan for that? Are there candidates for power? Is there an organized internal opposition or an external one? What next in Iran? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, to discuss how this war started, I'm joined by Anshul Pfeffer, who's Israel correspondent for The Economist. Anshul Pfeffer, who was the driving force behind this attack on Iran? Was it Israel or the United States?
Well, it was a combination, I think, of Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel, almost weeks after the 12-day war in June, had reached the conclusion that a significant part of Iran's ballistic missile project had remained intact, or intact enough for them to renew production pretty quickly. So that was unfinished business from Israel's perspective. And I was hearing from military sources already in late summer last year that Israel would have to go back and do at least a limited operation against that. Then fast forward to 4 months, and you've got Donald Trump's sudden message to the protesters in Iran that help is on its way. And then all of a sudden you have this dynamic whereby Donald Trump is somehow saddled with this promise, and he wants to show that, unlike Barack Obama, who sort of failed Iranian protesters during his presidency and also failed to enforce the red line on Bashar al-Assad with a chemical weapons attack in Syria, he had to prove that he was going to follow through on this. And that created a dynamic from the American direction. So I think these two vectors joined together in the war that we've seen over the last 5 days.
Okay, so taking out missiles is one thing. Taking out the entire Iranian leadership is another, which has
that's,
been
that's
done.
Quite a mission creep, yeah. I think that it's very much a combination of these two leaders. Netanyahu has over the years tried to talk other American presidents into attacking Iran. And at the same time, other Israeli prime ministers haven't put that kind of pressure on American presidents. So I think if we didn't have this combination of Trump, the rule breaker, and Netanyahu, who thinks that he's someone who can lecture American presidents, this wouldn't be happening. But it's very much the two people together.
Right. Two people together, but not necessarily with exactly the same war aim. You've said that Israel's proximate war aim was to get rid of the ballistic program. Has that war aim therefore now mutated to something else?
So I think that without a doubt, Israel's war aims have changed and become much, much more ambitious, because two other things that have happened since. One is this wave of protests we saw in January in Iran, which was without a doubt the most serious challenge that the regime faced. And once that happened, it did, I think, introduce into the decision making the question of whether this could be a tipping point. And the other thing is that this time America is not just launching one strike and basically letting Israel do all the rest of the work. America is part of this war from the very beginning. These are joint operations in which America is adding its incredible military resources to Israel's considerable military resources, but certainly not on that same level. So you have both an opportunity and the means for much more than just targeting the missile project.
What does that mean in practice? Does it mean the installation of an Iranian government which is more friendly to Israel, or simply an Iranian government which is much weaker than the previous one?
Well, even the most ambitious regime changes that I'm talking to here in Israel acknowledge the fact that to install a new government in Iran, you have to have boots on the ground. And I'm not aware of any Israeli or American plans to do that. What they are trying to do is engineer the conditions whereby there, first of all, could be a much wider and sustained uprising of Iranians against the regime, and in which the regime would no longer have the forces to suppress them as they did in January. So that's being done by attacking headquarters and offices of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, which also controls the Basij militia that actually did the suppression of the protests in January. And I think it's also done by showing to the Iranian people how weak their leaders are in standing up to this American and Israeli attack.
What is the Israeli assessment, Anshul, of the other possibilities? Because Iran is actually a fairly complex country, isn't it, with actual different nationalities in it, and actually different armed groups have operated on the edges of it. Is any part of Israel's objective, do you think, to assist those existing groups in their war against the Iranian regime?
Well, I think it very much depends on who you talk to in the Israeli establishment. There are those, and I think Netanyahu is probably one of them, who would be very happy to see Iran descend into a long civil war in which various minority groups in Iran carve out their own enclaves. And this would obviously be not a very good outcome for the Iranian people. But from a cynical Israeli perspective, this would remove a threat from Israel. There are other Israelis who think that it would be much better for there to be a more gradual transition within Iran towards a more reform-minded, less revolutionary type of a regime in Iran, and perhaps eventually a return to the kind of place that Iran was before the revolution, when Iran was actually one of Israel's closest allies in the region. But I don't think anybody really has a clear blueprint of how either of those outcomes can be achieved.
Clear blueprints are one thing, actually. Does anybody actually even have the vaguest idea?
Well, they have a very detailed idea of what strikes they're hitting every hour and every day of this war. But Israel's always been much better at planning wars than at planning the outcome or the end game of these wars. And I think we're seeing a prime example of this right now.
Anshul Pfeffer. Before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which looks at the prospects for peace after 4 years of war in Ukraine, and the one which examines the debate around social media and potential harm to young people.
Support comes from Wise, the smart way to manage the currencies you need around the world. Your life is global. Your money should be too. Some providers promise no fees on overseas transfers. Don't be fooled. Extra costs often hide in bloated exchange rates. Choose Wise. You can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies. Count on the exchange rate that you'd usually see on Google. That's how millions save billions on hidden fees. Be smart. Get Wise. Visit Wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Now, back to Iran. I'm joined by Professor Ali Ansari, Founding Director of the Institute of Iranian Studies at St Andrews University, Dr. Burcu Özalik, Senior Research Fellow for Middle East Security at the Royal United Services Institute, and Laurel Rapp, Director of the US and North America Programme at Chatham House. First, Laurel, we've heard from Anshul Pfeffer what Israel's motives for this war with Iran were. What do you think the motive for the US was?
President Trump has kept this question very open. We've heard shifting explanations and justifications of whether it's focused on, as the White House has told Congress, on ballistic missiles. Is it focused on nuclear weapons? Also a justification the White House has given Congress, but also the Iranian regime as a state sponsor of terror. And the question is this a narrower operation focused on taking out some of those military capabilities, or is there a more expansive objective of changing the fundamental nature of the regime itself? Look, the President Trump is seeking to maintain maximum flexibility in this to then be able to define a set of goals once they have been achieved, right? And that is at this stage where things seem to be going, a war that may last weeks but not years, not a forever war. Look, American public attitudes largely oppose military action in Iran. That number, 27% support U.S. military action. That number rises a little bit if the objective is focused on dismantling Iran's nuclear ambitions, but it drops significantly when talking about regime change. And this president, this American president, is focused on polling. He seeks to shape it. He's also focused on market effects, global energy prices, the sort of commercial disruption that we're already starting to see. And so as this conflict goes on, the costs will drive the ultimate goals and objectives here.
Laurel, if you're not clear about what your objectives are, which one is your objective, how do you know when you've met them?
That is the key question here, right? When you make a plan, when you write a strategy, I was a U.S. diplomat for many years, and one of my most recent assignments was writing grand strategy for the United States. You always start with, what are you trying to accomplish? And then from that, you apply effects, U.S. tools in service of that goal. And that's your plan. And when you have a set of unclear objectives, at least publicly, it makes a plan harder to execute. But in this case, again, it allows a level of flexibility to say, hey, you know, we accomplished the task we set out to accomplish, very much in the style of the George W. Bush mission accomplished banner in the months after the start of the Iraq War. Having a sort of time-bounded end state here in this conflict is something that this White House probably wants, because as time goes on, the costs will grow for this conflict.
Laurel, in Venezuela, the U.S. lifted out the president and left the regime intact. So there wasn't regime change in Venezuela, but has talked overtly about regime change in Iran. So that we're as clear as we can be, is the U.S. administration's idea of regime change not that it makes regime change happen, but that it hopes that it will happen, but won't do anything to ensure that it does?
In the opening days and hours of this conflict, President Trump spoke directly to the Iranian people and said, "You know, this is your moment. This is a singular moment in generations that you have to rise up, to take your country back, to take your government back." And so that is very much in the playbook that the U.S. administration is promoting. But then the question is, what are the tools that you're going to apply to that end? In Venezuela, you had a singular leader removed and sent to a Brooklyn jail. But the regime beyond that is fully intact in Venezuela with a slightly more compliant leader, right? That was with consent from the White House on who that person would be. We've seen that that's a model the White House wants to apply here in the case of Iran, too. This is a very entrenched, very long-serving Iranian regime that has really perfected the ability to survive against all odds, against significant international pressure, against economic strangulation, right? And so that is going to be a bit harder here. Look, Trump said the worst case scenario is that the Iranians pick somebody that's, you know, quote, just as bad as the supreme leader. And so then the question is, what does the U.S. do? Does the U.S. seek to continue a military operation to bring about a different end? Or does it kind of wash its hands, blame the Iranian people, right? That is sort of the frame that President Trump set up at the top, that this is Iran's opportunity to squander.
Ali Ansari, I think the question now is what's left of the regime in Iran after 5 days of attacks from the U.S. and Israel. As far as we know, what does it look like?
Well, you're quite right to say that we need to approach this with a degree of caution because it's very difficult to see what's going on inside given the internet blackouts. In theory, at least, they have a three-man sort of interim administration by the president, the head of the judiciary, who's an extremely nasty individual, Mohsen Ejei, and a member of the Council of Guardians. But I'm not necessarily sure they're running anything at the moment. It may be that Ali Larijani, the National Security Advisor, is doing something. But it seems to me, I should say, that as the Foreign Minister Araghchi inadvertently, it would appear, admitted, there's been a lot of devolution going on, and military commanders around the country are basically taking their own initiative. And I think this is probably reflected in some of the quite eclectic targets they've chosen over the last 5 days. I mean, they've attacked...
Is that the Iranian regime?
Yes. I mean, in terms of the Americans and the Israelis are certainly pounding regime infrastructure in quite an unprecedented way. And it's difficult to know in institutional terms what will be left as we head out of the bombing campaign.
Boris Hazlitt, we spoke 3 weeks ago with you on this programme, and we were talking about some of the people around the Iranian leadership who were influential, who might conceivably take over at some point. I mean, one was a guy called Ali Shalkani, the billionaire, who I understand is dead now. Another was Ali Larijani, who Anna just mentioned, head of the Supreme National Security Council. How significant do you understand him to be now? And also, the same question as to Ali, who is actually left centrally?
Well, what we know is that in the very early hours, if not minutes, of the campaign, key figures, including, of course, the supreme leader, but alongside him, key military, security, and regime figures were killed. And this is significant. Names included Ali Shamkhani, as well as the head of the IRGC commander, intelligence units, Ministry of Defense. This is a strategy of leadership decapitation that is clear, and this tracks with at least the Israeli playbook as we've seen it over the past 2 years in its conflicts in the Middle East. I think we are in the very early stages of this campaign or this war. And to fixate or to focus extensively on any one man at this stage, I think, is premature. Any name that is put forward as the likely contender or the future leader of the regime will have a target on his back. That is clear. But it's also the case that so much might change. The regime is being tested now. Yes, it is a system that has been designed to survive. It has mechanisms to ensure resilience and continuity. But the regime has not been tested before to this extent. We are seeing an unprecedented level of combat power being deployed across Iran. And this will have unmissable implications. Larijani, it should be noted, was sanctioned by the United States as recently as January for his role in not only carrying out, but seemingly endorsing, envisioning the violent suppression of Iranian civilians during the protests. I do not see a scenario where, if Larijani survives, the United States is going to say, we will work with you. I don't see that happening.
In which case, Ali, it seems quite likely that somebody, either American or Israeli, will try and kill him.
I mean, it's interesting that they haven't targeted him yet, but I tend to agree with Bertrand. I mean, I don't see these sort of regime insiders, the closer elements, as being people who the United States or Israel will legitimately want to talk to. There are people further out in the periphery of even the Islamic Republic who might be more amenable.
But the supreme leader has gone. Now, as I understand it, Iran's constitution requires a supreme leader, and it has a particular way of choosing them. Who is up for being supreme leader? And I suppose a follow-up, Burcu, is it likely that as soon as that person is named, somebody will try and get rid of them?
Yes, I suspect the latter part of your question, I suspect so. Israel in particular will have a very specific target deck and in line with leadership decapitation strategies. There has been rumors in the past few days, heightened rumors, that the son of the supreme leader, Mojtaba, is first in line to take up the seat of supreme leader.
This is Khamenei's son.
That's right. There are rumors that the IRGC, or the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, are pressuring the assembly of experts, the decision makers, effectively.
And these are clerics.
That's right, who will decide on the next supreme leader. These rumors are unconfirmed, however. I suspect there will be some internal bickering, competition over who to nominate, who has the right qualifications, the credibility. I think an important point, again, we shouldn't focus too much on the specific name, but the process, the aftermath, the survivability of the regime. I don't see a situation, or rather it's unlikely, that the Iranian people will choose to revert to the status quo in Iran after the experience of this war. So some type of transformation is very likely. Whether that means the supreme leadership, that role, is done away with, that's a different kind of question, and it's premature to ask that.
What do you think about this question of whether or not there are any kind of transitional figures within the possible figures within the regime?
There have been some rumors that the United States, via the intelligence community or the administration directly, has been speaking with some insiders in Tehran. There is just a lot going on in back channels, potentially, that we don't know publicly. But whoever emerges will have to be accountable to the Iranian people. They will also need to recognize that Iran will have experienced severe pounding during the course of this war and will need economic recovery and relationships, not only with the United States, but with its Gulf allies as well.
Ali Ansari, are there signs that the regime is cracking?
I think, you know, the key change in the dynamic that we've seen is that the regime and the regime apparatus has basically had a monopoly on violence. And now that is dissipating. You know, once they confront a sort of a population that starts to hit back, for instance, or they find themselves constrained in actually exercising that violence, I think you will start to see a lot of fractures in the system.
Oh, so should we be a bit clearer about that, Burcu? I mean, because what's being envisaged there is a moment when people do finally come out onto the streets, and instead of shooting them down, a section of the regime says, we're not going to do this, actually, we're with the protesters. Can we envisage that?
That would be a decisive moment. That would require high-level defections and mid-level defections across the security apparatus as well. One scenario that has been floated, that has been considered, to my understanding, by both U.S. and Israeli planners, is that the Iranian conventional military, the Artesh, takes over the reins and slowly but surely erodes the influence, the high level of penetration of the IRGC. The Artesh might be able to command a higher level of support, loyalty, and credibility in the name of Iranian nationalism rather than a Shia ideological Islamist regime.
Which begs an obvious question, which you may not know the answer to, which has the Iranian armed forces, which might conceivably be part of this force, has that also been significantly degraded by American and Israeli action?
That's a good question. As far as we can track from open source reporting and satellite imagery, no, they have not been as directly attacked as IRGC installations and assets.
Okay, let's imagine for a moment that there is this possibility of a fracturing of the regime. It would still seem, Ali Ansari, that you would need some kind of a figure. The one that has been mentioned here, I think because no one really knows about anyone else, is the son of the Shah, Reza Pahlavi. So let's deal with that first. He's outside. He hasn't been back to Iran for years and years and years. How credible a figure is this as a kind of figurehead within Iran for a new regime?
on the one level, there's an extraordinary level of Pahlavi nostalgia that's gripping the public imagination in Iran, and I don't think you can underestimate it. I think many people in the West have actually ignored it. Whether Reza Pahlavi himself can actually take advantage of that is another matter, and I think that there are, you know, there are several steps that need to be taken before one could imagine a sort of a royal restoration of that level.
In the last day or so, there's been talk about the US encouraging Kurdish rebels in Iran. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I think it might be worth talking about a dynamic that is emerging that has been, I think, in the planning stages for some time, and that has to do with American and Israeli support for a localized Kurdish armed insurgency in the northwest of Iran. Iran is a Persian-majority country. However, it is also a multi-ethnic country with the sizable minorities that include the Azeris, the Baluchi, and the Kurds. The Kurdish people predominantly reside in sort of the western part of Iran in an area that borders Iraq and Turkey. There is an armed group that might now be used, it appears to be, as the forward ground forces supported by the United States and Israel. This is a group called PEJAK. More recently, there have been rumors that this armed group will or has started early stages of mobilizing from within Iraqi Kurdistan across the border into Iran. And so now this is a big question because, and we're seeing this happen in real time, the Iranian regime is severely weakened from a military point of view. If another front opens along the borderlands led by Kurdish factions, what will this mean in the mid to longer term with respect to civil unrest, instability, and stabilization across Iran?
Laurel Wright, quickly, is this Kurdish possibility something that's being very actively discussed in Washington?
President Trump called senior Kurdish leaders in Iraq just days after this war started. Look, the U.S. is not at this stage thinking about U.S. or allied boots on the ground in Iran. And so this offers an attractive option, potentially, in the U.S.'s eyes, to offer that local force. The U.S. and Kurdish forces have had very long and complex and often disappointing relations over the years in terms of U.S. commitments versus what the U.S. has actually delivered. And so I think the kind of two questions are whether the U.S. is willing to escalate in this way and to begin to provide, you know, substantial equipment and other material support to these forces. And then the other question will be about the degree to which these Kurdish forces trust the U.S.'s staying power in this.
Ali Ansari, what would it need, really, for somebody on the Iranian street to say, I'm now going to put my body on the line for regime change? What kind of help does that person, do those people, need to see from the United States to fulfill that invitation?
So in part, you could say they're already seeing, you know, that effort in the attempt of the US and the Israelis to degrade those regime institutions and the forces of repression. I think the danger point comes is, you know, once the bombing campaign stops and you do get people out on the streets, depending on how defanged, in a sense, the repressive forces have become, you would still need a measure of sort of what we might term overwatch in terms of the fact that they would, unlike what George H.W. Bush did, he basically abandoned the Iraqi Shias to their fate. And Saddam Hussein then went straight in. And as we know, there was a tremendous bloodbath. So I think there needs to be a retention of some sort of a maintenance of sort of air cover and others to make sure that the regime apparatus is not able at the end of the day to sort of bite back.
Well, we talk about the Iranian people as if they were one entity, and then we also say that there are several different ethnicities and so on. But I imagine that there are people who did support the regime, because that's always the case. Is one worry here that we might slip into a situation of civil war in Iran?
There is a possibility, and I don't think we should discount that wholesale. Again, I will caveat this by saying that this is very early days, so I don't want to be seen or go on record as forecasting potential civil unrest. But at the same time, as the conflict evolves and especially if the United States and Israel are able to maintain, to sustain air supremacy over the skies of Iran, it is possible, it is likely to see a scenario where Iranian protesters, Iranian citizens, make claims upon the regime and want to have a say in the future foundation of a new we, a collective.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Ali Ansari, Burcu Özelik, Laurel Rapp and Anshul Pfeffer. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirsty Knight and Nathan Gower. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
If journalism is the first draft of history, what happens if that draft turns out to be flawed? In 1999, four apartment buildings were blown up in Russia, hundreds killed. But 25 years on, we still don't know for sure who did it. It's a mystery that sparked chilling theories. Because these bombs, they're part of the origin story of one of the most powerful men in the world, Vladimir Putin. I'm Helena Merriman, and in a new BBC series, I'm talking to the reporters who first covered this story. What did they miss first time round? The History Bureau, Putin and the apartment bombs. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Support comes from Wise, the smart way to manage the currencies you need around the world. Your life is global. Your money should be too. Some providers promise no fees on overseas transfers. Don't be fooled. Extra costs often hide in bloated exchange rates. Choose Wise. You can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies. Count on the exchange rate that you'd usually see on Google. That's how millions save billions on hidden fees. Be smart. Get Wise. Visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.